Well, hello, hello, guys. You're listening to Beauty Bites with Dr. K, Secrets of a Plastic Surgeon, and I have some secrets for you. Today, we're going to talk about the microbiome and why it is a hot topic. We have a really amazing expert. Kiran Krishnan came on the podcast day, maybe it was about 2 years ago, blew my mind, and the science has exploded so much since then. Kiran is a research microbiologist, health and wellness expert, entrepreneur, and educator. He spent 2 decades, the last 2 decades, translating this complex science of microbiomes into like strategies you could actually use. He co-founded Microbiome Labs. He has published research, scientific textbooks, and global patents in the microbiome space. So today we'll talk about skin microbiome. What is the acid mantle and why is it so important? How microbes help your skin barrier? And what about skin dysbiosis? How does that lead to all these problems we have, like dermatitis, allergies, food problems, probably even aging? Welcome to the podcast, Kiran.
Thank you so much for having me. It's wonderful to be back.
Shall I call you Dr. Krishnan or shall we stick with
No,
Kiran?
Kieran is perfect. Thank
Kiran
you.
and Kay are going to have a little chat. So, for listeners who are new to the whole entire concept of skin microbiome in general, why should they care about it?
It's a really profound concept, right? So we've all known, for example, we just take the skin itself, forget the gut microbiome for a moment, which is really complex and very impactful in your overall health. But let's look at the skin. The skin is known to be the largest organ in the body. We've always thought of it as just this barrier that prevents things from going out and things from going in from the outside world. But now we come to know that the skin is much more dynamic than that, right? There's this neuroimmune endocrine axis related to the skin. The skin is really an amazing sensory and signaling organ that indicates to the inside of your body all of these things that are going on the outside. And your immune system response, your hormones response to it, and so on. And at the end of the day, all of those things, all of those functions are dictated in large part by the microbes that are present on the skin. It's a 35-to-1 ratio of skin cells to microbes on the skin. And we're talking about bacteria, viruses, fungus, and so on. And all of those microbes play a very important role in how the skin is structured, how it functions, and then also how it affects your overall health. So we have to consider what's going on with the ecosystem on the surface of our body.
I think that people don't know what the acid mantle is, but that's one of the most important features of healthy skin. Can you explain what's the acid mantle? Why is that foundational?
And you hear about pH of the skin quite a bit in cosmetic products, right? They talk about products that are pH balanced. And then as we're digging into this further, we go, okay, what is going on with the acid mantle of the skin? Number one, you start to realize that it's a very narrow range, right? The optimum range for the acidity of the skin is between a pH of 4.5 and 5.2, which is a relatively narrow range, right? And then the question becomes, how is that maintained, right? That's external. Everyone knows that the stomach, for example, produces stomach acid, and stomach acid is incredibly important. But we've got glands in the stomach that produce hydrochloric acid that we need, but we don't have acid production on the skin. So, how is this pH maintained so well? Then you start to realize, well, your oils that are secreted come out in triglyceride form and so on, and then you've got a mix of some minerals from sweat, and all of that actually gets metabolized by microbes on the skin to release fatty acids. And it is those fatty acids that actually acidify and maintain that very narrow pH range of the skin. And we know that if the pH goes off that narrow range, things start to fall apart, right? So we start to look at the first barrier feature of the skin, and that is the pH of the skin. And that is one of the most important things to keep in mind as we're thinking about the health of the skin.
Should I be testing my patient's skin pH? Could you do that with like regular pH strips, or do you have to use specialized like iontophoresis type equipment?
Yeah, I think you can utilize strips to get a pretty strong idea of how off the pH may be. But there's some really clear examples of what happens, right? So for example, you can assume that the pH of the skin is off when your patients are showing up with increased sensitivity or reactivity of the skin, right? That is one of the key features of dismantle pH within the skin. If it's too high or if it's too low, skin increases its sensitivity and reactivity, and we can explain why that is. You start to see an increase in redness and chronic low-grade inflammation on the skin. So those patients that show up with the redness in the skin and that hyperreactivity, right, the immune response on the skin, that is typically starts with a pH imbalance. You also start to see patients that tend to get breakouts that are atypical in nature, right? And then you start to see dryness in the skin. So most people that struggle with a significant amount of dryness, that is an issue of the pH of the skin as one of the driving factors. And then another piece of evidence is slower recovery, you know, repair of the skin, the function of the keratinocytes and the matrix metalloproteinases and all that to facilitate repair is pH dependent. Right. And in fact, the lipid layer, so, you know, the ceramide layer that protects the skin, that acts as kind of the mortar between the skin cells that prevents moisture from evaporating, the maturation of the ceramides are dependent on pH. And so you don't get the pH, if you're not within that pH range, you don't get proper maturation of the ceramides. And then you end up with much more dry, flaky skin. And then most of the enzymatic function on the skin to activate and you know repair the skin, most of those enzymes function in that narrow pH as well, which is why when the pH is off, you get lots of barrier function issues. And one last big thing when the pH is off, especially if the pH is elevated, you get fungal overgrowth. That's a foundational driver of fungal overgrowth in people. And then we know all of the problems that that can lead to.
And then you need to acidify the skin if that's happening. So
Exactly.
that pH testing would be interesting. I saw a patient yesterday and her skin was just red, inflammatory, acne. You could just tell something's wrong in her gut and her diet. I even quizzed her about what he liked to eat. She's like, I'm a pescatarian, but I do like spicy. And then, well, maybe I do like carbs, but I only eat sourdough. And then I'm like, I don't even know where to start with the dietary corrections for that. But I, you know, of course I told her have prebiotic, probiotic, maybe a supplement with acromantia, but like, where would you start with the diet advice? Because you see this visible problem on the skin. Don't we need to start with diet or do we start with barrier repair?
I would do absolutely both. The gut skin connection, the gut skin axis is a very powerful influencer on the skin. And in fact, ceramides, for example, that she would need to improve the barrier function in the skin, those ceramides actually come from the diet. They come from sources called phytoceramides, which come from rice bran and other fiber sources. So one of the things that she probably really needs is an increase in fiber intake, and then the ability to convert that fiber into a particular type of short chain fatty acid called acetate. Acetate that's made in the gut actually ends up in the skin and other areas distal from the gut. And in the skin, for example, one of the things acetate does is it repairs damaged cells. It helps facilitate damaged cell repair, and it dampens down immune responses as well. It acts as a strong anti-inflammatory. And so I would, in her case, she should remove gluten. She should likely remove dairy if she's likely sensitive to it. But a lot of people with sensitive skin tend to have casein and other sensitivity. So if she can remove gluten and dairy for a period of time and then increase her fiber intake, increase her polyphenol intake, and then utilizing a probiotic like a spore-based probiotic, which converts the fiber into the short-chain fatty acids, that will be a brilliant start for her from the gut side. And then from the topical side, I would use a serum that can help balance the skin microbiome to bring back the growth of the organisms that manage the pH and manage the acid mantle. You know, like the SIB serum, for example, SIV, that can help do that as well.
What is the SIB serum? I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, so that's one that I'd worked on with a group in creating to help rebalance the skin microbiome. It's called SIV. Used to stand for skin IV, but now it's called SIV. We've done studies on it on eczema, on dermatitis, on acne, a number of examples of inflamed, broken barrier of the skin. We've done skin microbiome swabs to see how it actually changes the skin microbiome, and as a result of that, completely changes the barrier function and thereby the inflammatory pathologies on the skin as well. So something like that could be very beneficial for her.
That's so interesting. You mentioned the spore-based prebiotics. So what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so there's a type of probiotic out there called megasporebiotic. These are spore organisms only. So these are Bacillus endospores versus your conventional lactobacillus and bifidobacteria, which you find in lots of different probiotics. Now, the advantage of the spores is there's studies that are published that show that the spores do a really great job of facilitating the metabolization of fiber and prebiotics into short chain fatty acids, right? And ultimately, that's what we want out of the fiber and the prebiotics. We want the conversion to short chain fatty acids. So, somebody that already has a bit of a messed up gut, like this patient likely does, they simply won't convert enough of their fiber into short chain fatty acids. So, you want to add the spore probiotic in there to facilitate that. One study, actually, I was one of the authors on this study we published. We saw that we can increase the conversion of short chain fatty acids to by 150% just by adding in the spores that facilitates that reaction.
Is there a brand that you typically favor or recommend? We can mention brands because I'm all about the learning.
Yeah, absolutely. So the easy to access brand is one called Just Thrive. Just
Oh,
Thrive
yeah,
Health.
I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one I use myself. And then for clinicians, it's Megasporebiotic, but Just Thrive does exactly the same thing. It's fantastic.
Okay, perfect. And then do the bacteria, one of the things I want to impress on the audience is you can take a probiotic every day, but it kind of just washes right through. How do we increase these kind of keystone commensal bacteria that live in us and with us and become part of our, flora and our background
Yeah,
terrain?
how do we get them up and have them at high
How
at
to make them
appropriate
live
levels?
there? And yeah,
Yeah.
the good ones need to take up house, live there,
Yep.
and be like, existing with us.
Yeah, the biggest driver of that is diet. So most of the keystone species, especially the most important ones like say Akkermansia or Bifidobacterium longum or Faecalibacter prausnitzii, all of these organisms feed off of polyphenols and fiber. And when it comes to fiber, we want a diversity of fiber, right? So we need a combination of soluble fiber and insoluble fiber. And typically, it's like 70% soluble and about 30% insoluble. Now, that can get confusing for people, right? But these days, fortunately, they have AI. They can go on chat or Claude and say, hey, Claude or chat, give me an example of what I would eat each day if I want to get 30 grams of fiber a day, 70% soluble and 30% insoluble. It'll give you all of these wonderful examples of nuts and seeds and berries and bran and cassava and all these wonderful things, right? So the intake of fiber and then the intake of polyphenols, and you want about a pound of polyphenol-rich berries per day. It sounds like a lot, right? But
A pound? A
about a pound,
pound?
yeah.
Wow. Is that like a square carton of blueberries or more than that?
Basically, yeah, it's
Oh,
basically
wow.
that. Actually, about half of that may even be enough, especially if you're getting a mix, right? So let's say you get some blueberries, blackberries, strawberries. Anything in the berry family contains the right type of polyphenols that really feed Akkermansia and really feed some of these keystone species. And just think about, after each meal, maybe get a few hundred grams of a handful of berries, if you will, as your dessert. Everyone likes a little bit of a sweet treat. So instead of going for a cookie or a piece of cake or something, do a handful of berries. And that goes a really, really long way in feeding the keystone species and getting their numbers up. Now, the spores, we also published a study in 2019 showing that when you take the spore-based probiotic that I mentioned, the Just Thrive, for example, it increases some of the keystone species because the spores can compete against dysfunctional organisms that the keystone species struggle with competing with, right? So the spores come in, they start knocking down some dysfunctional organisms. That gives more room for the keystone species to increase.
Wow, I think that's so helpful to know. Like, I need to adopt that habit. I have not been doing that. I
Yeah,
mean,
it's
I
so
eat
powerful.
blueberries here and there, but like a sprinkle. It just
Yeah.
seems to be a ton of and you're gonna, for the audience listening, you get polyphenols from any rainbow colored fruits and vegetables, so the bright things brighten.
Absolutely, yeah. And the other advantage of that, right? So within the category of polyphenols, there are compounds called carotenoids, and some of these carotenoids are very powerful antioxidants. We had actually done some studies when I was running microbiome labs back in the day, showing that both dietary and supplemental carotenoids play a very important role in protecting the skin from UV from blue light irradiation. And even from UV to a certain degree, but blue light irradiation for sure, which we're all exposed to consistently, right, on a day-to-day basis. And so yeah, there's additional side benefits. And then these
And
polyphenol.
carotenoids are more, they're more than just in carrots. You can also find them in other fruits that have high vitamin A content. So what would that be like?
Yeah, so most of the berries will have a carotenoid content in it. They'll have things like astaxanthin, zeaxanthin, lutein, right? Lutein is also found in them. You can also get it from things like green tea. So black tea, green tea, both of those have a good amount of carotenoids and polyphenols in them. So if you're making green smoothies, the colors of the rainbow, the fruits and vegetables, those all contain both polyphenols and carotenoids. And you know, when you look at like long-term studies on diet and macronutrients that have a massive impact on overall health, right? Nothing compares to the studies on fiber and polyphenols. For example, fiber, there was a study that was published in 2020. It was a meta-analysis study of almost 1 million subjects. They showed that for every 10 grams of fiber you add to your daily diet, you can reduce your all-cause mortality by 10%, right? Which is massive. And that's all the way up to around 40 to 45 grams, which reduces it 40, 45%. After that, it's a little bit of a diminishing return. So you can't get to 100%, unfortunately. But imagine being able to reduce your risk of dying from all disease states by 40 to 45%. That's massive, right? And that's just by getting 40 grams of fiber per day. Then you add polyphenols on top of it, and polyphenols work differently than fiber. So this is likely an additive effect for those that got more than, you know, it was somewhere around 450 milligrams of polyphenol per day, which you can get from about a pound of the berries that we talked about. Those individuals were able to reduce their all-cause mortality by 25 to 30%. So just between those two things, right? If we're diligent about it and we do it every day, and most of it is good and easy to eat, we can dramatically improve our health and reduce our risk for long-term conditions.
Wow, does that apply to like powdered and soluble fiber, fiber gummies, or any kind of fiber? Fiber is fiber, or I do I really, of course, you want to sit and eat a giant bowl of salad, but you don't always have
Yeah.
to. So, can I get fiber gummies and I'm going to be just as good?
Most things in gummies will not necessarily absorb the same way, but fiber is going to be a little bit different. So, if it was like an active ingredient, say creatine in gummies, I would always favor the capsule or the powder over the gummy because it's hard to get the creatine out of the gummy. Fiber is a little bit different because we don't digest the fiber anyway. So it doesn't matter if we break it down in our small bowel and absorb it. What we really care about is that it makes its way into the large bowel. So when it comes to fiber, gummies, if that's the way, that's the easiest way to stay compliant with it, absolutely do it. Now, the ideal scenario is you want a diversity of fiber, right? So you want some nuts, some seeds, some root vegetables and tubers, so some potatoes and cassava and things like that. Then you want some leafy greens and fiber from that source. Then you want some fiber from fruits, and then some supplementation, some simple psyllium husk, for example, or PHGG is one of the most well-tolerated fiber, even for people that tend to be very sensitive to it. It's called partially hydrogenated guar gum. PHGG people can look for. And then resistant starch. Resistant starch is also very well tolerated and easily adds to the fiber intake. So what I've done, for example, with my goal of reaching 40 to 50 grams of fiber per day, I supplement with each meal about 5 to 10 grams, right? So what does that mean? It means prior to the meal, prior to eating food, I take about 5 to 10 grams of soluble fiber. Now, the soluble fiber does a couple of the interesting things. Because soluble fiber is soluble in water, it forms a gel structure. So when you consume it, it goes into your stomach and it binds water and it forms a gel. And as a result, it expands your stomach. And when it expands your stomach, it does the same thing that GLP-1 agonists do. It triggers a satiety response and it triggers a fullness and it slows down gastric emptying, right? So that means that number one, your glucose response is going to be blunted from whatever meal you're eating. Number two, you're going to eat less. Automatically, you'll eat about 20%, 25% less. Because you'll feel full much faster. And so you're going to have all these metabolic benefits of weight loss and insulin, better insulin control, and so on top of getting the fiber, right? So, and then if that meal itself contains some fiber, say another 5 grams or 10 grams from some vegetables or fruits or roots and tubers and nuts and seeds and so on, then you've got about a 15 grams of fiber in that meal. About 8 to 10 grams of it before the meal that actually gives you metabolic benefit as well, right? So that becomes a really cool strategy to do it.
It's so good to know that. I should definitely adopt that. I have a very important question for you. What does Diet Coke do to my microbiome? Because it's my one vice, and I'm like, I'm sure it may not be positive. I don't know if I want to know the answer, but I kind of want to know the answer.
Well, what's so interesting about it, right? The automatic knee-jerk response is that it's not good for the microbiome. When you dig into the studies, though, okay, so I have not found any real credible information that it's really bad for the microbiome. Even if the sweetener that they use, because I think in Diet Coke they use sucralose, right? Now, sucralose is not great. Of all the sweeteners that are out there, I prefer, for example, sugar alcohol. So I prefer that they're using erythritol than or inulin or xylitol kind of sugars versus sucralose. But nonetheless, it's not as bad for your microbiome as you think, right? And so I would always play this balance game for me. It's an 80-20 rule. If your microbiome was fairly resilient, then if you get a certain amount of joy and functionality from that Diet Coke, then by all means have that Diet Coke and all the other decisions are good decisions in your day, right? And so I really hesitate to tell people to clean up everything, right? Because I think we have to also live and we have to have a little bit of joy and a little bit of fun in this life. And so if a piece of cake makes you feel better, if a cookie's good, if a Diet Coke gives you some psychological response and also makes you feel more energetic, by all means do it, but then make the other 80% of decisions the right decisions and the microbiome will remain resilient. Right. And so everyone that asks me, like, what are my health goals when it comes to my microbiome? I always say my goal is resilience because I don't want to have to be healthy by making 100% the right choices. I want to live by the 80-20 rule. I want to make 20% bad decisions and still be fine. Right. Because there's a lot of living that happens in that 20%. And so, and it's only practical. Right. I mean, we all see the biohackers online that seemingly live these perfect lives and every decision is meticulous for their body and all of that, but that's not feasible. That's not humans. That's not
Not
how
fun.
we function, right?
No.
Yeah. And so it's unattainable. And so to me, the response to that is be more resilient so you can make poorer decisions.
Yeah, in terms of alcohol too, then is that got the similar kind of impact?
It's exactly the same. Yeah. For me, so alcohol is, it can be toxigenic to the microbiome. But again, in bursts and spurts, if you're drinking every night, that's a different thing versus social gatherings, and if I'm going out to meet friends and it's a birthday, I'm going to have a couple of drinks, and I'm not going to sweat it because I know that my microbiome is going to be fine, given that I'm working hard 80% of the time to build that resilience, and that's really human nature, right? So if we think about humans having evolved as omnivores, we were forced for long periods of time to eat non-ideal things, right? And our system tends to adapt to these changes, and our system is resilient. If we're making majority good decisions, our system will be fine.
I think that's so true. You mentioned a little bit about the skin barrier, the pH, and how we change and dry as we age. What kind of changes do we see in the microbiome with menopause patients, both on skin and gut?
So huge, huge. In fact, it's one of the big drivers of all the change in disease risk for women as they hit menopause, right? So we know that women catch up to men with cardiovascular disease risk, with diabetes, with obesity risk, and all that once they hit late perimenopause to menopause. We also know, and this is really profound. I've been doing a lot of work in the joint health space in osteoarthritis, and understanding the role of the microbiome in osteoarthritis, because one of the things I found is that between the ages of 45 and 55, women report newfound musculoskeletal pain 10 times more frequently than men do, right? And so women are much more susceptible to new onset of pain in that critical period of perimenopause to menopause. And so, of course, then you have to look at, well, what's the connection? It's not true before that, and it's not true in the 60s. In your 60s, men and women are about the same, but in that critical period, women seem to accelerate. So one of the things we know that occurs with estrogen levels dropping is that when estrogen levels start to drop in perimenopause, the diversity of the microbiome starts to go down quite dramatically. And then inflammation in the lining of the gut increases. The gut lining has estrogen receptors, and binding of estrogen receptors in the gut actually facilitates an anti-inflammatory response. The microbiome, there's also microbes that feed off of estrogen, which is one of the ways in which we clear it through the body, right? And so as estrogen levels drop, you get two things that are happening. You get lowering of diversity in the gut microbiome, and you get an increase in inflammation. Both of those lead to a condition called endotoxemia, which is the clinical impact of leaky gut, which means that now you've got these toxins, in particular one called LPS, that leaks through more often and ends up in circulation. It goes through the liver first. It creates a lot of toxic effect on the liver, and then it escapes the liver and goes throughout the circulation. Now, that elevation in LPS in circulation and in the liver is directly associated with an increase in cardiovascular risk, with osteoporosis, with obesity, with anxiety and depression, and also with skin conditions. Right? LPS increases inflammation in the sebaceous glands and other immunological structures within the skin. It thins out the skin, and it reduces the diversity in your skin microbiome. Now, the diversity in your neck and face, you don't want very high. You want a predominance of Cutibacterium and Staph epidermidis, but on the body, you want high diversity. On your skin microbiome, the diversity on the body comes down dramatically as estrogen levels decrease as well. So for women who are going into menopause, it becomes extremely important for them to focus on the diversity in their gut microbiome, right? And the diversity on their skin microbiome and modulating the skin microbes, because inevitably those two things will go down as a result of estrogen going down and inflammation goes way up.
That's so interesting. I think women need to know this because, things sort of slowly and visibly change, but there is that one layer barrier between the GI tract and the body. It's such a strange concept. What can we do to actually improve that barrier thickness so this LPS is not diffusing through,
So the things that actually stops LPS from leaking through, the spore probiotics, for example, that we talked about earlier, we've published at least two studies on it in a gastroenterology journal showing that if you take even just a spore probiotic by itself, there's about a 60-70% reduction in that leaking in of LPS. So that in itself can be very useful. There's a product called immunoglobulin G, IgG,
Oh,
that is a
yes. Is that
supplement,
sort of
right?
like the colostrum type
It
treatments?
is. It's like colostrum has some immunoglobulin G. In this case, it'll be a concentrated form of it. So if people just search IgG or bovine serum IgG, those you'll find, a dozen products on the market that have that. Those that IgG binds LPS in the gut, that toxin in the gut, and reduces inflammation in the lining of the gut. Another one, and this can be a dual action for women, is an ingredient called lactoferrin, right? Because the other thing women suffer from is anemia, right? And lactoferrin is responsible for increasing iron absorption. So just taking iron supplementation and eating steaks is not going to do much for your ferritin levels. It's not going to do much for your iron levels. What you really need is lactoferrin, which then facilitates the absorption iron. But lactoferrin also modulates inflammation in the lining of the gut, and it binds to LPS. So look for lactoferrin as another ingredient. So if you add spore probiotics, IgG and or lactoferrin, if you could do both, it's fantastic. And then get your fiber in, get your polyphenols in, like we talked about. And then the last thing is manage your stress, right? Stress has one of the biggest impacts on your skin, on your gut microbiome and your skin microbiome, right? Because there is this skin neuroimmune axis. Right. And we all are familiar with this to a certain degree because we know, for example, when people who are prone to dermatitis or people who are prone to acne, when they're really stressed, they get flares, right? Their acne flares, their dermatitis can flare. You get all this
Cold sore
cutaneous,
breakouts, everything.
exactly, choroidal breakouts, all this inflammation, right, on the surface. That is part of this of the skin's neuroimmune axis because the skin is acting as a signaling beacon, if you will, for the impact of stress inside the body. And then also often it leads to more fidgeting, more scratching, more itchiness, and that itch scratch cycle is also a skin neuroimmune cycle. And so and all of that just facilitates more damage to the barrier, more inflammation. So managing stress is one of the most powerful things you can do, both for your gut microbiome and your skin microbiome, right? And then the question becomes, well, how do you manage stress, right? There's so many things that people talk about doing, mindfulness work and all that. My response to people is, number one, do whatever you think can work for you. It doesn't matter if it's drawing, sketching, deep diaphragmatic breathing, sauna, whatever it may be, going for a walk. But some of the things you can do to facilitate those actions is utilizing a psychobiotic, right? A psychobiotic is a probiotic bacteria that works on the gut-brain axis that dramatically reduces the fight or flight response, which is what we're in when we're in a stress state, right? An example of a psychobiotic on the market is a product called ZenBiome, ZenBiome. It has a strain in it called Bifidobacterium longum 1714 that has about 9 published studies, randomized controlled trials on managing anxiety and stress response. And it can be a real big help along with the other things you may do, like, meditation, breathing work, walking, weightlifting, which is very powerful against stress, because when you lift weights and you increase resistance on your muscles re release a set of compounds called myokines. Some of these myokines are actually very strong endorphins and actually modulate stress response. Some of them actually help the lining of the gut. So weightlifting can actually be very beneficial for your stress response, for your gut, and thereby for your skin as well.
That's so interesting. Could you repeat the name of that Bifidobacterium bifido? You tell me.
Longum, yeah. The brand name, the brand name is called ZenBiome, ZenBiome, and it's B. longum, so it's Bifidobacterium longum 1714 is a strain ID. It was actually developed at University College Cork in Ireland. Fascinatingly, they were looking at, Irish women who slept really well, who were jolly, who nothing bothered them, and they were comparing them to people with high stress and anxiety. They were looking at the gut microbiomes, and what they found was that the women who had very controlled moods and slept really well had very high levels of this Bifidobacterium longum 1714 in there. So they isolated the strain. And then they looked at what was going on. And then I had the pleasure of working on this strain early on. And here's what we figured out what's happening here. And this is so fascinating. So when you consume this strain, it goes into your gut. It doesn't live in your gut. It goes in, and at this terminal end of your small intestine, it sits there, and your own immune cells, called dendritic cells, reach across the lining of your gut. They grab these microbes and pull them into circulation, right? Which in itself is a crazy thing that your immune cells are pulling in bacteria from your gut into your circulation. But they do this. And then what they do is they digest the bacteria, and the bacteria have a very unique carbohydrate on the outer surface. They release those carbohydrates into circulation. Those carbohydrates actually have a way of binding receptors like glucocorticoid receptors and facilitating the downward regulation of cortisol response and stress response, right?
Oh,
It's
wow.
such an elegant thing, and nature's already created this magical thing for us. We just have to know enough to utilize it.
I love that. That is incredible. And then when they've looked at microbiomes of the centenarians that lived to be more than 100, they've also identified some key findings. Do you know, can you talk about what that is?
Yeah, there's a few things. So number one is their diversity of the microbiome tends to be very high. And as you age, you lose diversity in the gut microbiome. We talked about how for women, part of that is facilitated because of the reduction in estrogen. For men, it just continuously happens from your late teens onwards. The diversity keeps going down. And so what they find is centenarians tend to have very high levels of diversity in their microbiome, which is absolutely correlated with longevity. They also found that they have certain key species. So keystone species in general are really high in them. But in a lot of these centenarians, they have very high levels of a type of lactobacilli called Lactobacillus reuteri. Now, reuteri is really interesting, right? Because it's assumed that reuteri plays a very significant role in the release of oxytocin. And oxytocin, right, is our love and bonding hormone. It works antagonistically against the stress hormone. It also gives us a sense of community and bonding. And that's one of the key features of centenarians is that community structure, right? They have purpose and community are the two things that are basic among all centenarians, no matter where they are, whether they're in Okinawa, Japan, or they're in Costa Rica, or they're in the part of Italy and Sardinia. All of them are the same. Their diets are a little bit different, their habits are different, but there's two things that are always true is that they all have a strong sense of community and a strong sense of purpose. And when you lose that community and you lose that purpose, then you rapidly start to decline, starting with your mitochondria, your cells, your organs, and so on. And that bacteria, reuteri, facilitates community and purpose.
So interesting. So when I retire from working and having community and busyness and purpose, is my microbiome going to change? Maybe.
It
Maybe
might,
that happens.
unless you find your new community, right? In that case,
Right.
so for example, in Sardinia, Italy, or even in Okinawa, Japan, it is very, very common for all the retired older people get together every day. And in
Yeah.
fact, they dress up, they ride their bikes, they meet at a cafe, they sit and talk.
Yeah, so cute. When are
Yeah,
we going
it's
to
that
have that
community.
here? Like, what the heck? There's no Starbucks hangout. Seniors, Starbucks for seniors. We need
Right. We need that, right?
that.
We
We
need
put them in
group
a nursing
meetups.
home in isolation with no
Yep.
sunlight, talking to strangers. Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah. And what are they seeing in nursing home, right? So you imagine if you're someone in your late
Bad bacteria.
60s,
That's
right?
probably.
Yes, exactly. If you're someone in your late 60s and you're put in a nursing home, you're in there with people in their 80s and 90s who may not be very healthy and may not be at a very good stage in life. And that's what you have to look forward to, right? You're seeing your future self when you're looking at those individuals. That doesn't give you a lot of hope. It doesn't give you a lot of sense of purpose, and then you start to start to lose your own self, knowing that now you're in this 20-year sentence to end up like that. And so what people need is to maintain activity, maintain a sense of purpose, gather together, do some service together, start a company. It doesn't matter if you're 70, start a small company that does something tiny, right? It doesn't matter. You
Like
just need a sense of
volunteering
purpose. Totally,
something.
like volunteering. Yep, exactly. Mentoring, all of those kinds of things, right? That's what we're really missing in the Western world, right? We isolate ourselves quite a bit as a result of technology, and in our most active times of life, we are on the go a lot, like both you and I are. And then we look forward to this downtime, but we forget that in that downtime is when we need community even more, right? Because right now we inevitably have community because we have our staff that we care about, we have our families, we have the colleagues and all these people and a sense of purpose. Then we think about just kind of kicking back by ourselves, but that's not really what facilitates health and purpose, right? So we need to find those communities as we get older.
I definitely think so. I'm super interested in skin and the skin bacteria and how we nourish the skin microbiome. So you mentioned the pH 4.5 to 5.2. What can we do to improve skin microbiome? Are we overdoing it on the cleansing and the amount of products that go on? I always worry, and I dislike the idea of a 10-step Korean routine because I think the number of preservatives and ingredients and compounds and really ingredients that are not great that go on your skin must be insane.
Absolutely. I mean, I think if we were to list a few daily habits that have a negative impact on the skin microbiome, it would be number one, cleansing too aggressively and too frequently, right? So we are cleansing our skin with antimicrobials and things that kill microbes, usually twice a day. That's very unusual if you think about it, right? I mean, through most of the course of human evolution, we never did that. And so that can be really damaging the skin. Also, avoiding over exfoliation, right? So we've got this practice of just really exfoliating the skin way too much. I mean, soaps have exfoliants in them and all that. So now you've got a detergent and an exfoliant, which again can disrupt the top layer of the stratum corneum, which is actually a food source for the beneficial microbe on the skin, right? So we don't want to slough off that skin. We all have this, our skin has this natural desquamation process. And part of that process is the microbes on the skin actually metabolizing the dead skin cells, the proteins, and all that that are in there. So we want that there for the food, for the microbes. And then, of course, drying out of the skin. Drying out of the skin has a huge impact on the microbiome of the skin because so many of the microbes on the skin feed off of the oils that are produced in the skin, right? And so when our barrier becomes dysfunction, our ceramide layers become dysfunctional, and our skin dries out, that kills the microbes that are on the skin. We also want to be, like you mentioned, very strategic about the personal care products, right? There, you can very easily do too much of it. If you're just looking at, and I would challenge people to do this, right? Look at your skincare routine, and let's say you've got six products in that skincare routine that you're using twice a day or once a day. Just add up all the actives, all the ingredients that are in all of those products, right? You may end up with somewhere around 75, 80, 100 plus ingredients that you're putting on your skin once or twice a day. That can be quite a bit. That can be quite a lot. And the thing is, most of those things are not tested for its impact on the skin microbiome, right? The testing is around sensitivity to the
That's so
skin,
true. None of our
right?
skin products get a microbiome eval. You
They
need to
don't.
start that, Karen. You need to start that. Wouldn't that
That's
be so cool if it's like
what.
stamp of approval for protecting your good microbiome?
Totally. That's one of my goals is to develop a devise a standardized way of testing whether or not a product is going to impact the skin microbiome. Because really, what we're looking at here when a product is tested is does it create any sort of immediate or delayed hypersensitivity on the skin? And that's typically from a single or just a handful of exposures. We just don't know what the combination of all these things will do to the ecosystem, right? And then things that people may do at home that break the barrier too much. You know, I've talked about, for example, microneedling can be very beneficial, but the goal of microneedling is to, you know, do a controlled damage, and then you get the benefit from the rejuvenation and the repair, right? But if your skin barrier is already damaged, and people use microneedles that are too long, or they're doing it too frequently at home, for example, especially not under the care of a skincare professional, you can cause more damage. You can prolong the inflammatory response. You can translocate dysfunctional bacteria from the very surface deeper into the skin, right? You can actually cause repair a signaling that is more scarring than rejuvenating, right? And so you want to be careful that if you're not really taking care of the barrier of your skin, you want to be careful on things that break and disrupt the barrier on purpose, where you're counting on the rejuvenation aspect of it improving the skin, right? So people need to be more self, more conscious about that, not overdo these things at home. Oh, I can't hear you.
Such good information. I have so many patients who are buying home microneedling kits and they think they're doing themselves a great service by twice a week, 3 times a week microneedling, and it's just really destroying the skin barrier. And also, yeah,
It is.
unsterile, introducing God knows what bacteria there. So, in the office, when we do microneedling, is there anything we should be aware of? Because we do create these beneficial channels. Would you recommend perfusing anything into them that's good for microbiome? Other than what we normally do, which is like platelet growth factors and sometimes exosomes.
Yeah, actually, there's one compound that can be very beneficial for once you create channels or you create any sort of damage to the skin in order to facilitate the best version of rejuvenative repair, and that is beta glucans.
Okay.
So beta glucans have a tremendous amount of research on them in terms of facilitating the best and fastest form of repair on the skin with minimizing the inflammatory process, right? And so if you're doing any sort of injections, microneedling, any sort of dermablations or peeling, I would absolutely look at a beta glucan cream.
Like
There's a
what? Which kind?
So there's a company called BWH Labs. I just got a bunch of their beta glucan cream because I'm super excited to use it myself and do some further testing on it. And they've got some great studies. So BWH Labs, they have a beta glucan cream that
Okay.
is an amazing reparative driver. And then I would follow that up. So for the first couple of days after creating channels, I'd be very selective about what goes on the skin. I would use the beta glucan cream, and then after a couple of days, I would use the something like the Civ serum so that you get the microbiome balance back in on the skin, and you'll see a significant difference in how well the skin repairs and rejuvenates. And in fact, it facilitates that most youthful form of repair rather than the potential, you know, dysfunctional repair on the skin.
That's so interesting. So I should probably build that into our regimen. And
Yeah.
then for surgical wounds and things, topical antibiotic cream applied, like a Neosporin, Polysporin, is that a generally, in general, we don't really need to do that if the wound's
Right.
clean and sterile. But would you say don't do it anymore for people who scrape their knee? Don't do that.
Yeah, I would so what one of the discoveries around the skin microbiome and repair of the skin that is super interesting is that studies show that when there's any sort of break in the skin, like let's say a laceration, a scrape, it doesn't matter how deep the break is, as long as it's in the epidermal layer or lower. The first things that actually migrate to the edge of the broken skin are the microbes on your skin. And they migrate to that edge and start turning on the repair mechanisms, right? So
Right.
the activation of keratinocytes and all of those things that are going to play a role in repairing, it's the presence of the microbes. So then if we maintain a sterile surface on that wound, you're likely going to slow down the repair process. Now, it's absolutely important to clean a wound when it's there. Well, you know, like when my kids, for example, cut themselves or they scrape their knees, we wash it, soap and water, right? And then from that point on, it's about keeping it hydrated. Because we want that hydration. We don't want to maintain a sterile environment because we want their skin microbes to actually start working and multiplying and migrating to the surface of the edge. So one of the best things is things like Vaseline, right? So once you've cleaned and sterilized it, put a thin layer of Vaseline on it. Bandage if you need to, if it's an area that'll get rubbed on, touched too much, or if it's like an open forearm or something, just thin layer of Vaseline, and then let the microbes do their thing.
It's so interesting. When we laser patients, then are we just ablating their entire superficial skin? And then our regimen of putting Vaseline on, is that enough? I think now I need to add the beta glucan if it's not too stingy, and definitely the sieve. And like, I'm just so curious about what microbiome step should I take when I do laser? How about when I do a collagen stimulator? How about when we do neurotoxin? Does that screw with the microbiome?
So I think the neurotoxin itself probably not, but the act of injecting does impact the skin microbiome to some degree, right? But these are pure, very, very fine points of injection. So I think that doesn't have a massive impact on the microbiome, but it can. So I would say that any of those processes where there is some sort of damage that occurs to the stratum corneum and epidermis of the skin, I would absolutely look at a reparative cream like the beta glucan for the first day or so after the procedure, and then going to something like the sieve that can help restore the microbiome balance in that area. We actually get really, really phenomenal results with the sieve, for example, when people use it a day or two after they do a peel or after they do microneedling and create channels. And then, of course, I would do the beta-glucan cream right after the procedure. And then Vaseline for the laser is perfect, but I would add the beta-glucan and put Vaseline on top of it.
Wow, this is wonderful. I'm going to email you and we're going to get a whole list of all my shopping cart that I'm going to get for the
Yes.
office and for myself. And like, where do you, are you in LA? Where are you based?
I'm based in Chicago, actually.
Oh,
Yeah, in the Midwest here.
Chicago. Okay, that's so
Yeah.
cool. Well, I have learned so much in this short hour. I really have like one more page of questions, so we might have to do it again soon because I
That's
don't
it.
want
We'll
to
do it
take your
sooner
whole
this
morning.
time.
Yeah, part one. We're going to do a
Yeah.
part two. Part three. Oh, that's part three, actually, because part one was, if you guys scroll back, you can hear a year ago, we did a great one that was much more acne focused, which we didn't even touch on today. But I think the building the microbiome, building the mucin layer back in the gut, getting happiness bacteria, these are such takeable concepts that people need to incorporate into their life. So I can't thank you enough, Karen. Where can people find you on your Instagram and your other handles and give a plug to your skincare line too?
Thank you. So on Instagram, my handle is Kiran Biome, KiranBiome. So please reach out there if there's any questions, and I try to put as much good information out there on your microbiome as I can. I have a free membership for people from my circle community at BiomeLC, BiomeLC. Lots of resources there. I connect you with practitioners who are really well versed in the gut microbiome if you have gut issues. And then I also have a couple courses there as well. And then check out the sieve, the skin microbiome. It's the website is sivcare.com, so www dot sivcare.com. We've got great studies on dermatitis, anything inflammatory in the skin, any thinning of the skin, and we just actually completed a study on age spots as well, seeing a
You're
significant
kidding. Okay.
reduction.
I need to see that. Maybe you can send me that. And I'd love to, I think we should definitely get some for the office, but
Yeah, absolutely. We predominantly sell it through professionals. So yeah, it'll fit really well in your office, and especially for everything that you guys do and how complete you think about skin and holistic health of skin. So it fits well.
That's so incredible. Well, you guys, I had such a good time learning about microbiomes because I'm a nerd like that. But I also think it can change the course of how you age and your health patterns. So please do incorporate these tips into your life. And don't forget to find me on Instagram at Beauty by Dr. K, DRKAY, Beauty by Dr. K. Dot, and our website is the same, beautybydrk.com. And that's where you'll find me doing amazing things with people's faces. Much more microbiome incorporation into skin. And I have a brand new skincare line that's peptide based. It has mitochondrial boosters, NAD precursors and GHK copper, glutathione. It has three peptides that I came up with that are specific for collagen and elastin stimulation. So I'm super excited. I'm going to send you some too.
Oh, I would love that.
Yeah, it's such a great line to increase activity of the skin cells because they become senescent and they wear out. But that's it for now, guys. I hope you incorporate lots of good microbacteria into your lives and stay beautiful.